G'day, I'm Linda Ross and welcome to the Garden Clinic Digs Deeper podcast, where we go right around Australia chatting to friends and gardeners, garden designers and garden lovers about our favourite passion, gardening. Thank you for joining us today. If you've got any garden questions, please head over to the Garden Clinic Facebook page and we'll help you out as soon as possible.
The best garden in the street.
G'day, Graham Ross here. Now, you all know I love my gardening and we all know that Seasol is simply fantastic for keeping your garden healthy and looking great. But did you know that Seasol reduces transplant shock and dramatically increases the plant's survival rate when they're newly planted? Now, look, it's like an insurance policy for your plants. So when you're planting out your seedlings and new plants in your garden, don't just water them in, Seasol your plants.
Don't forget the Seasol.
He captured Australia with his totally no-nonsense approach to cooking, often cooking with homegrown food that's just been picked from the garden and sustainable local produce as well. He single-handedly led a tree change back to the country with that gorgeous farm of his in Tilba. He inspired a new generation, a younger generation, to live more sustainably, and that begins with cooking at home, growing your own veggies and deepening your relationship with your local butcher, your greengrocer and your local community. He is, of course, best known as the host of River Cottage Australia. Paul West is the guy that you'd love to have as your next door neighbour. G'day, Paul. Welcome to the podcast.
G'day, Linda. Thanks for an incredibly flattering introduction. Inspired a whole new generation of young people. I like that.
Well, as I talk to my friends, all their husbands love you. And that's saying something. All my friends' husbands are just like, oh, that guy is totally awesome.
He's all right.
I love this guy.
Chainsaw and drives around in a ute. What a champion.
I don't know. You just was the perfect mix.
But you can call me up and we can chat anytime.
How's life treating you these days?
It's treating me really well, yeah. So to update your listenership, I don't live on the farm in Tilbury anymore. The show was production ceased at the end of 2015, and I've done a little bit of work here and there in the interim, but now I'm living in Melbourne, and I'm writing a book about growing food in backyards.
Oh, you know, you started off as a chef in Melbourne.
Yeah, I did. That's true. I used to work at a restaurant called Vudemon.
That's right.
I always say Vudemon, but super more specifically, classy. I worked in the bistro there, so not the three chef's hat one, but in the one hat bistro, which was more classical cuisine, classical French cuisine. It was 80s and 90s Michelin era stuff, but modernized somewhat. And I feel like the opportunity was always there for me to go up into the three hat restaurant, but I never took them up on it because at the time I was there, it was the real height of the kind of El Bulli inspired molecular gastronomy era.
Yeah, right, that era, yep.
And, you know, in the bistro, which was certainly regarded as less prestigious with both the clientele and the actual chefs who worked there themselves, the food that I was cooking was essentially modernized peasant food. You know, it was high quality, simple cuts with really not that much done to them, but just with great length, taking the source best possible produce and you know, give it a tickle just enough to turn it into a fine dining experience.
So really that philosophy hasn't really changed with
no,
you?
No, well, it hasn't.
You know?
No, it's, but I can just remember being in the bistro one day and watching some of the chefs from the restaurant work, because we had a shared kitchen and separate dining spaces. And I was just looking at the process and the finished product, and the food didn't resonate with me at all. It doesn't resonate with me to go and eat it. It doesn't really resonate with me as a trade or as something that I wanted to learn. You know, foams and gels and tweezers and you know, food for the appearance rather than food for the quality.
Well, I think all of the cooking shows that I'm watching at the moment, you know, like Ugly Delicious.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of food that they want to eat too.
Well, I think that's... anyone was, you know, genuinely asked, you know, what would your, the classic question is, you know, what would your last meal on earth be? Can pretty much guarantee that most people would refer to something very simple, you know.
Yeah, usually home cooked and usually a food or a meal that they would have had in their childhood that their mum cooked.
Exactly. Something without fanfare, comfort food, essentially. That's really what people tend to say for that. And I do myself. And I think, you know, programs like Ugly Delicious are have spawned from our modern food culture, where we live in such a visual time where most of our media is consumed in pictures more so than words now, you know, looking at Instagram, for example. And there, it's kind of, you don't get as much context. So the food that's presented has to be really visually appealing. It has to be spectacular. And because you can't taste it, it doesn't matter what it tastes like. It doesn't matter how impractical it is to eat, yeah, or how long it took you to make or how expensive it was to make, as long as you kind of get that great shot. Whereas I think there's been a realization among a lot of people, myself included, is that the best food isn't necessarily the most photogenic food. I mean, if you whip the top off the slow cooker, you know, that you've, well, I've got
something
away in my kitchen right now with like a lovely beef and pumpkin curry in it. If you took the top off that, that's not the most visually spectacular thing you've ever seen. But if you put it steaming in a bowl, enjoy it with some nice rice and some yogurt, it's spectacular. And I can't wait to eat that for dinner tonight now that I'm talking
Now you've mentioned it, I'm off to do a curry myself. What did you love most about that four-year Tilba River Cottage experience?
The highlight of that time, it's a tough question because, you know, there's obviously so many.
You more seem so to than, really resonate with the local community. The characters there and their passions, I think, were brilliantly transferred in your show.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's, I think rather than like a particular moment or specific event or dish as being the highlight, I think maybe more of a theme was a highlight for me. And you touched on it just there, and the wonderful connected nature of the community down there was, it was just so amazing to be a part of.
Do you miss them?
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so I'm not living there at the moment, but my family and I still have a house in Bermagui.
I love them.
That's the best. Great little town.
So great.
Yeah. So my oldest son is 3.5, and we want to start him in primary school back there. So I've moved away from the South Coast just while my kids were pre-primary school to basically chase work while the iron was hot, so to speak. And then we hope to return at some stage next year to get everyone set up so we can start primary school there in 2020.
Oh, I know. Isn't that when you're a young parent? You're thinking, primary school,
right.
2020. I remember I had 2017 etched on my brain when my little one started.
Yeah. Well, I just, you know, I...
Life's different, isn't it, when you've got little ones?
It really is. It really changes everything. You know, there's, obviously you keep the core of who you are. And when I say it changes everything, it changes it for better or for worse. It's just a cold fact that when you inject two young people into your life, things are going to get different. For me, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And it's better molded me as a cook, I think. It's really helped my transition from being a chef to being someone who cooks solely for people. Strange way to describe it.
Oh, and for pleasure.
In a non-commercial kind of sense. And I guess I realized the importance of my role as the kind of food provider in the family or the cook in the family to how much of an impact on my children's health and well-being and happiness the food that I put on the table for them are.
As they get older and they're at school for, 8 hours a day, the meal is actually one of the only times you really get to sit, concentrate and talk.
Yeah.
Kids
ahead of me. Oh,
yeah. The food's the most important thing. Yes, that's it. You're like, please give me adult conversation.
8 hours.
I know, blissful hours. Oh, that's why parents are so happy when they're waving their children off to school.
We do love them. But that importance of the meal as that kind of sharing time and the time where everyone stops and distractions of the outside world fade away, and it gives us that chance to connect on a basic level. I mean, it's something that's been a part of humanity since time immemorable. It seems like a relatively recent phenomenon that sitting down and breaking bread with your family and friends and loved ones is almost a thing of the past, because we're all so busy. You know, we've got to eat on the run, eat on the fly.
Yeah.
I've got to be, I'll take dinner on the couch while I'm answering an email because it's 8 o'clock at night and I've been at work for 10, it's just kind of like hectic stress mill. To at least give a little bit of reverence to that family time, I think has a whole raft of benefits beyond just, the nutritional qualities of what you're putting in your mouth. I think where you get nourished on many different levels.
So I hear that the book is in the pipeline, and that's growing, food in your backyard, which is just so my favourite topic of conversation. Is it that an easy thing to do for you at the moment in a smaller backyard? What percentage of veggies would you be eating that would be directly picked from the garden?
Say we're probably at about 20% over winter. Yeah.
Winter's a big growing period, isn't it? So you're growing for a long time before you can actually pick.
And if you miss the boat, especially in these southern climates, I mean, if you don't get stuff in when there's still a little bit of heat left, then the growth is absolutely glacial. March, was it? I think at the end of March, I just had a huge plant out of predominantly leafy greens, because I find in winter that is the thing, like leafy greens and herbs, it's the thing that I really want, because, you know, I'm eating so much of this slow cooked stuff, so it's kind of got that, you know, that slow cooked soft brown quality that a bowl full of greens and herbs picked fresh from the back garden is a really good nutritional and textural counterpoint to all that.
So what are your favourite leafy greens at the moment?
I absolutely adore mustard greens.
Yeah, it's got that real
like the red, like the ones that are the real, you know, kind of maroon red quality. And I just love the pepperiness and the kind of intensity of flavour that brings.
Red elk is one of my favourite mustard greens with that little fine texture. But super mustardy, it tastes like a little bit like, for me, my palate is probably not as refined as yours, but I feel like it's like horseradish, so I just chuck it on a rare roast beef sandwich.
Yeah, see, exactly. And I think, you know, that's why I'm probably subconsciously leaning towards the mustard there, because, you know, I eat a lot of slow-cooked beef in particular.
They're a good parrot.
Made in heaven, absolutely. And then I just grow a stack of like mixed open head lettuce varieties and some mizunas and just basically any sort of leaf that will grow in an open leaf forming habit. So I can just pick and go, you know, without having to go like, oh, there's a whole cos lettuce. Oh, there's my iceberg lettuce. Better harvest that and eat that now.
Yeah, you cut and come again and greens are easy.
Exactly, exactly. They're perfect. And so for winter, that's really my focus, because, I mean, otherwise be growing things like cauliflower and cabbages and I do have a couple of mini cabbages and some wombok, mainly for preserving once they're, you know, for fermenting and preserving once they reach maturation. And I've got a couple of like broccoli rabe plants, you know, the sprouting broccoli.
Oh, the sprouting broccoli are 1,000 times better than any normal broccoli. Oh, exactly. I don't know why they're not more renowned, like more common. I think we should only be planting the sprouting broccoli, like the calabrese, rather than that stupid little head of broccoli that you get.
Absolutely.
Like, I mean, you get
especially for a backyard
so much more bang for your buck.
Exactly.
Like 60 sprouts rather than one little head.
Just one head, that's right, that no one wants to eat.
No one wants to eat anyway. And it just
cruciferous.
Tastes like, I don't know. It's, sulfury, a bit sulfuric.
So, well, for me, like a selection of sprouting broccoli is like selecting the open-headed varieties of lettuce. It's one of those little things that you can do, and it's like a selection that maybe new players don't know about that gives you the kind of maximum bang for buck when growing in your backyard.
And that prolonged harvest, 3 months rather than the one pick and then it's
over. So it's maximum efficiency and the kind of best yields and most variety.
Just one thing from England that we just didn't translate is that sprouting broccoli, the green and the purple. I don't understand.
Oh, dear.
And I think the Italians call it calabrese.
Yeah, right.
And so
they know good food.
Calabrese. 2 meters high, 60 or 70. It's like if the broccoli made love to asparagus.
Yeah.
It would give birth to sprouting broccoli.
That would have been a sorted affair.
But you get that long stem and that little sprout on the end, which is just delicious.
Yes. Yeah. I think around 20% is pretty safe bet for us. You know, mainly a big bowl of greens every day, and as much variety in that.
So good. And don't you think it's ironic that, you know, salad greens grow so much better in winter than summer?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I consider that ironic, or I think if I consider that appropriate, that it's kind of,
I suppose, when you need it.
Nutritionally, when we need it, is kind of the depths of winter, because we're no doubt eating a lot of preserved food, and, you know, there's none of that fruiting variety stuff, so we're probably eating more meat and things like that. So I think it's important to have that at the kind of seasonal time that we'd need that nutritional benefit the most.
Okay, so let's look at living sustainably, and there's some easy things that families and those who haven't really maybe hopped onto that bandwagon yet, but what are some just clear, sustainable aims that you can share with us to just help us at home?
I'm going to lay out some pretty basic ones, so I apologise if anyone thinks I'm teaching them to suck eggs.
No, we can go from the basics. I think it's a good place to start.
I think, like, absolutely the first place to start is cooking.
Yeah.
Because so many people don't cook at all, you know, or are mystified by the process. And I mean, when I say cooking, I don't mean like getting a packet sauce and adding pasta and one chopped up vegetable. I mean, actually learning to cook from scratch, everything. Like, so all your shopping's done, you know, in the fresh food sections of the supermarkets that you're only kind of getting stuff like flour and sugar if you eat that, you know, in the centre sections
or toilet paper.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know. No, that's all
but
I go
you,
for.
But you're not going down the central food aisles and buying tin stuff and, you know, and ready-made packet meals.
So real food.
Exactly, real food.
I mean, when did we forget that putting a nice, you know, organic chicken and roasting that up with a couple of spuds and a salad, that's the easiest meal you can make.
Yeah, well, oh, man, that's a weekly feature at our house for that exact
and
reason.
And then, hello, you know, chicken for the
stock at the end.
Your chicken stock for the end and then chicken on Sambo for the next day? Or?
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, to be honest, I don't know where that happened because it's one of those things where if you talk to your grandparents, your grandmothers, everyone knew how to cook, everyone, because there was no luxury to not cook. Couldn't afford to get Uber Eats 4 nights a week because, one, it didn't exist, and, two, it was so outlandishly expensive. So everyone cooked. And then for some reason, we seem to spend a lot of time watching cooking now, but spending very little time actually doing it ourselves.
But people just get annoyed at cooking because it takes ages. The mise en place cutting thing is annoying. I just like to put a podcast on or some music and actually just revel in the whole practice of cooking.
But I kind of understand why
people are like, oh, geez, it's just taking forever.
I
suppose it's just enjoying it. Yes. Yeah, okay, so let's say we are all cooking.
Okay.
And what's next?
Yep. I think after you learn to cook, then the natural progression for me would be to start trying to grow a few things. I'm not necessarily talking about selling up the house and moving out to somewhere like River Cottage and raising all your own meat and growing all your own vegetables.
It did seem like a full-time job.
It was intense. And I think one thing that a show like that in the lifestyle kind of format does a disservice in is that it doesn't really accurately portray the kind of
effort.
How difficult it is.
Yeah, the effort required.
Exactly. Yeah, it's all, I mean, it was a wonderful program to be a part of, and I feel very glad to have done it. But I almost feel like I'm doing some people a disservice when they go, oh, I love River Cottage. I want to go and do that too, when they've only ever seen that lifestyle on River Cottage, not actually the kind of warts and all
reality of it. Go and talk to a real farmer. Not that you won't.
No, but you do tap into a very primal.
That does tap into a primal need for humans to do it themselves.
Yeah.
Like it is a romantic notion for us to want to grow pigs.
Yeah. Well, and I guess it's also it has the qualities of a simple life, that we all watched
The Good Life when we were eight.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that no matter how urbanized we are as a society, we're still not that far removed from our life in the regional areas where we essentially led an existence that's far more connected to nature than we do in our dense areas. Whether you're a hobby farmer or a real farmer, that's you can't escape the impact of the environment around you because you're outside all the time. You're seeing the seasons come and go and you're physically feeling the change and you're seeing the change in your garden and on your property and in the wildlife around you. You know, whereas, and I'm finding this now, of course, living in an urban environment, that it's a lot harder to feel that connection.
Yeah.
It's still there.
And food's harder to find. Like,
yeah, well, I don't know.
I lived in Sydney all my life.
Mm.
And I do grow a lot. We've got a great veggie patch. We've had it for 35 years.
Wow.
And my parents are horticulturists, so it's kind of... But I only just found a biodynamic farm shop that's 10 minutes from my house. I felt like I've won the lottery.
Ah, right.
And well, so see, I think, seasonal, I think, fresh. It's picked from the... You can see where it's picked from on the little farm. It's all biodynamic. And I just go every few days and just pick up the little bits and bobs that I need.
Yeah,
and my son, who's addicted to carrots so much so that he's actually orange,
he's got carotenosis.
It's a medical condition.
Where he turns orange.
His knees turn orange, his feet turn orange, and his hands turn orange because he would eat like 6 carrots a day. And mind you, I try to grow them myself, but he said to me, Mum, the carrots from that shop taste better than... Oh. Carrots that
which
you
is
buy
why I tend not to worry about growing
center.
Things like carrots and onion and stuff like that, but because you can generally find it very cheaply from really good organic producers.
Yeah.
So I usually just I try in the backyard because I mean I'm pretty limited to space. I don't know how you are, but I just try to grow the kind of high return, high yield, fast growing stuff that doesn't transport very well, and I really want to have that maximum freshness.
That's a really good point. There's so much good food these days available, and I just sort of specialise in my veggie patch just stuff that I can't buy elsewhere, like maybe purple potatoes or kohlrabi at the moment. Yeah. I love kohlrabi just sprinkled with lime salt. I could eat it forever. I don't know why kohlrabi, the purple Sputnik looking a stem vegetable.
Radish apple.
Thing, it's Moorish. I can't stop eating it. It's sweet turnip. It sounds weird, but it's totally Moorish. I really love it.
Raw as well, isn't it?
Best raw, I think.
Yeah.
And then limes are in season at the moment, so lime over that. It's the best little pre-dinner drink. Well, pre-dinner.
And how simple, you know.
It's so easy. It's better than a packet of chips.
It really is, though. And it's, but I think people, I don't know. It's a bit of a challenging one to think about how we've kind of lost our way with vegetable consumption and, you know, and people, it's the convenience of it all, I suppose.
With my kids, I tell you what I do now. Thursday night, stir fry night. every Thursday is always.
So that's gigantic.
They like the routine. They love Thursday. It's stir fry night. What are we having? Yeah. And packed full of it's only veggies. So I try to have a couple of meat free nights a week. So like Monday night sushi night. Tuesday night is Taco Tuesday, of course. But you can. Working full time. You know, a routine is great.
Wednesday?
I think that's a roast. Thursday is stir fry. Stir fry Thursday. But I mean, obviously the ingredients change for the season, but kids just love that routine and that really pumps them full of great veggies.
And we, like for ourselves, we found through trial and error that if we don't plan our weeks,
that's right,
we eat like crap.
And you know what?
It's last minute.
You waste a lot too.
Yeah,
if you don't plan.
It's 4 o'clock, and we'll be like, oh, what are we going to do for dinner? And they'll be like, oh, there's this and this and that. And, you know, you either have a terrible dinner or you go, oh, stuff it, let's go, let's get like a pizza or something like that. So we've kind of cut that right out. And now my wife and I sit down on Sundays.
I'm a big planner.
And, you know, again, it was when I was a chef, I guess I was one of those things like, oh, meal plans. Like when I cook, I like to go to the markets with a basket.
Every day.
See what inspires me and, come home and create some 5-course masterpiece. Whereas now I'm like, oh, my God, I've got to get dinner on the table
in 10 minutes
at 5:30 every night.
So true,
isn't
it?
That's right.
It's so
and the
true.
Mega meltdown.
No, you're absolutely right. So planning is the key. And I think when you plan, you've got the whole week ahead, and you've also, you're buying specifically for, so there's no wasted food.
Exactly.
It's pretty easy. But, we did poo-poo the whole planning thing when we were young. But I tell you, as you get older, it's great. You're just about to swap chilly old Melbourne with Queensland for the 3-day Queensland Garden Expo. That sounds so awesome. You're going to be on stage talking about what?
More about what we've just spoken about here. For me, in particular in the gardening context, I like talking about that real intersection of what we eat and what we grow. You know, there's no ornamental kind of chat in what I do. And what I really like to do, both in terms of growing and cooking, is trying to just absolutely simplify it as much as possible for people and hopefully inspire them through that simplicity to go out and give it a go themselves. When we watch things, whether it be gardening shows or cooking shows, if you don't know how to cook and you don't know how to grow, then that can be really intimidating.
It's quite puzzling for people.
When you're kind of in the fold, you're like, oh my God, but that's so easy. It's just some kohlrabi with some lime salt on it. So really, I guess, try to make people feel confident enough to just to have a go.
You're in good company because at the Queensland Garden Expo, there's Costa Georgiadis and Sophie Thompson from Adelaide and Jerry Colby Williams, of course, from Busy. There's going to be a mine full of information available for people at the 3-day expo, and it's at Nambour Showgrounds, and the dates are the 13th to the 15th of July. The website's just queenslandgardenexpo.com.au. It just sounds like it's going to be jam-packed full of 40,000 people all wanting to clamoring to know what you're doing now. I think there's 360 exhibitors, there's 55 nurseries, and there's 8 speaker stages.
Wow, man, this sounds bigger than Ben-Hur. I'm glad you remember the website and the dates for the pot, because I've totally forgotten.
It sounds absolutely like a place to be. We've been up a couple of years running. It's awesome weather at that time of the year, and every year I really look forward to it. Good luck.
Yes, thank you very much.
Good luck. And so lovely to have you part of my little podcast, Paul.
My pleasure. It was great to have a chat.
We should just chat on a monthly basis just to see what you're doing.
Anytime.
What's the plan for you and the family now?
So I'm we'll probably stay in Melbourne for another, say, probably about 12 months while I write this book, because I felt like if I was writing a book about food growing in backyards, that would be, I had to kind of live in a relevant area. Yep. So I'm living in Thornbury, which is in the north of northern suburbs of Melbourne, and a real heartland for backyard food growing in Australia. Then after that, once the book is submitted, I say the family and I will be moving back to Bermagui.
Oh, wonderful. Coast,
just because it's...
And it would be remiss of me not to check out how Dig is going.
He's good. I mean, he's had a difficult period of adjustment over the last 3 years.
Yeah.
One, because I've had two kids, two boys, which have each thrown him a further rung down the hierarchy.
Yep.
And also because he's gone from living in a regional area with space aplenty to living in a backyard in Melbourne. So, but I think he's adapting as a city dog.
How old is he now?
He'll be six in January.
Oh, he's still a young boy.
He's still a pup. And when he looks at me with his sad face, like, I guess I'll just sit in the backyard today. I'm like, Digger, I promise this is just a very short chapter of your life. I promise you that your twilight and golden years will be spent walking on beaches
years.
Morning and night. Fear not, my good dog. And then eventually they'll make a statue out of you and, you know, do something like that.
Well, the future looks very rosy for you and that wonderful little family of yours, Paul. I really hope you all the best. And I really look forward to hearing how you're going and catching up with what you're doing. And hopefully there's more television shows in the pipeline.
thanks very much. And it was really lovely to chat to you.
Thanks, mate. So if you want to catch up with Paul West, he's the guest of the Queensland Garden Expo on the 13th to the 15th of July at the Nambour Showgrounds. It's a fabulous show. If you're into gardening and you're anywhere near Nambour, head to it. There's 40,000 people, 360 exhibitors, 55 specialist nurseries. It's an absolute ripper. And for ticketing information and how to get there, just head to their website. So it's just qldgardenexpo.com.au. You've been listening to Linda Ross with the Digs Deeper Garden Clinic podcast. It was such a pleasure to catch up with Paul West and see what he's been up to since those heydays of River Cottage Australia. I hope you've enjoyed it, and join me next week. Happy gardening and go safely.
The best garden in the street.
G'day, Graham Ross here. Now, you all know I love my gardening, and we all know that Sea Sol is simply fantastic for keeping your garden healthy and looking great. But did you know that Sea Sol reduces transplant shock and dramatically increases the plant's survival rate when they're newly planted? Now, look, it's like an insurance policy for your plants. So when you're planting out your seedlings and new plants in your garden, don't just water them in, Sea Sol your plants.
Don't forget the Sea Sol.